That young man is nervous, said Poirot thoughtfully. He is on the edge, but absolutely on the edge. I glanced at Poirot curiously, but his enigmatical smile told me nothing. In company with Sir Guy Willard and Dr. Toswell, we were taken round the excavations. The principal finds had been removed to Cairo, but some of the tomb furniture was extremely interesting. The enthusiasm of the young baronet was obvious, but I fancied that I detected a shade of nervousness in his manner, as though he couldn't quite escape from the feeling of menace in the air. As we entered the tent, which had been assigned to us for a wash before joining the evening meal, a tall, dark figure in white robes stood aside to let us pass, with a graceful gesture and a murmured greeting in Arabic. Poirot stopped.
You are Hassan, the late Sir John Willard's servant?
I served my Lord Sir John, now I serve his son.
He took a step nearer to us and lowered his voice.
You are a wise one, they say. Learned in dealing with evil spirits. Let the young master depart from here. There is evil in the air around us.
And with an abrupt gesture, not waiting for a reply, he strode away.
Oh, evil in the air,
muttered Poirot.
Yes, I feel it.
Our meal was hardly a cheerful one. The floor was left to Dr. Toswell, who discoursed at length upon Egyptian antiquities. Just as we were preparing to retire to rest, Sir Guy caught Poirot by the arm and pointed. A shadowy figure was moving amidst the tents. It was no human one. I recognized distinctly the dog-headed figure I had seen carved on the walls of the tomb. My blood froze at the sight.
Mon Dieu! Murmured Poirot, crossing himself vigorously. Anubis! The Jackaledid, the god of departing souls.
Look, someone's hoaxing us, cried Dr. Toswell, rising indignantly to his feet. Look, it went into your tent, Harper, muttered Sir Guy, his face dreadfully pale.
No, said Poirot, shaking his head, into that of Dr. Ames.
The doctor stared at him incredulously. Then, repeating Dr. Toswell's words, he cried,
Someone is hoaxing us. Come. We'll soon catch the fellow.
He dashed energetically in pursuit of the shadowy apparition. I followed him, but search as we would, we could find no trace of any living soul having passed that way. We returned, somewhat disturbed in mind, to find Poirot taking energetic measures in his own way to ensure his personal safety. He was busily surrounding our tent with various diagrams and inscriptions, which he was drawing in the sand. I recognized the five-pointed star or pentagon many times repeated. As was his wont, Poirot was at the same time delivering an impromptu lecture on witchcraft and magic in general. White magic, as opposed to black, with various references to the Ka and the Book of the Dead thrown in. It appeared to excite the liveliest contempt in Dr. Toswell, who drew me aside, literally snorting with rage.
Balderdash, sir, he exclaimed angrily. Pure balderdash. The man's an impostor. He doesn't know the difference between the superstitions of the Middle Ages and the beliefs of ancient Egypt. Never have I heard such a hodgepodge of ignorance and credulity.
I calmed the excited expert and joined Poirot in the tent. My little friend was beaming cheerfully.
We can now sleep in peace, he declared happily. And I can do with some sleep. My head, it aches abominably. Ah, for a good tisane.
As though in answer to prayer, the flap of the tent was lifted and Hassan appeared, bearing a steaming cup, which he offered to Poirot. It proved to be chamomile tea, a beverage of which he is inordinately fond. Having thanked Hassan and refused his offer of another cup for myself, we were left alone once more. I stood at the door of the tent some time after undressing, looking out over the desert.
What a wonderful place,
I said aloud, and a wonderful work. I can feel the fascination. This desert life, this probing into the heart of a vanished civilization. Surely, Poirot, you too must feel the charm. I got no answer, and I turned, a little annoyed. My annoyance was quickly changed to concern. Poirot was lying back across the rude couch, his face horribly convulsed. Beside him was the empty cup. I rushed to his side, then dashed out and across the camp to Dr. Ames' tent.
"Dr. Ames," I cried, "come at once."
"Oh, what's the matter?" said the doctor, appearing in pyjamas.
"My friend, he's ill, dying. The chamomile tea. Don't let Hassan leave the camp."
Like a flash, the doctor ran to our tent. Poirot was lying as I left him.
"Extraordinary," cried Ames. "Looks like a seizure, or... what did you say about something he drank?"
He picked up the empty cup.
"Only I did not drink it," said a placid voice.
We turned in amazement. Poirot was sitting up on the bed. He was smiling.
"No," he said gently, "I did not drink it. While my good friend Hastings was apostrophizing the night, I took the opportunity of pouring it, not down my throat, but into a little bottle. That little bottle will go to the analytical chemist."
"No," as the doctor made a sudden movement,
"as a sensible man you will understand that violence will be of no avail. During Hastings' absence to fetch you, I have had time to put the bottle in safekeeping."
"Ah, no, quick, Hastings, hold him!"
I misunderstood Poirot's anxiety. Eager to save my friend, I flung myself in front of him. But the doctor's swift movement had another meaning. His hand went to his mouth. A smell of bitter almonds filled the air, and he swayed forward and fell.
"Another victim," said Poirot gravely. "But the last. Perhaps it is the best way. He has three deaths on his head."
"Well, Dr. Ames," I cried, stupefied, "but I thought you believed in some occult influence."
"You misunderstood me, Hastings. What I meant was that I believe in the terrific force of superstition. Once get it firmly established that a series of deaths are supernatural, and you might almost stab a man in broad daylight, and it would still be put down to the curse. So strongly is the instinct of the supernatural implanted in the human race. I suspected from the first that a man was taking advantage of that instinct. The idea came to him, I imagine, with the death of Sir John Willard. A fury of superstition arose at once. As far as I could see, nobody could derive any particular profit from Sir John's death. Mr. Blattner was a different case. He was a man of great wealth. The information I received from New York contains several suggestive points. To begin with, young Blattner was reported to have said he had a good friend in Egypt from whom he could borrow. It was tacitly understood that he meant his uncle, but it seemed to me that, in that case, he would have said so outright. The words suggest some boon companion of his own. Another thing, he scraped up enough money to take him to Egypt. His uncle refused outright to advance him a penny, yet he was able to pay the return passage to New York. Someone must have lent him the money."
"Well, all that was very thin," I objected.
"Ah, but there was more. Hastings, there occur often enough words spoken metaphorically which are taken literally. The opposite can happen, too. In this case, words, which were meant literally, were taken metaphorically. Young Blattner wrote plainly enough, 'I am a leper.' But nobody realized that he shot himself because he believed that he had contracted the dread disease of leprosy."
"What?" I ejaculated.
"It was the clever invention of a diabolical mind. Young Blattner was suffering from some minor skin trouble. He had lived in the South Sea Islands, where the disease is common enough. Ames was a former friend of his, and a well-known medical man. He would never dream of doubting his word. When I arrived here, my suspicions were divided between Upper and Dr. Ames, but I soon realized that only the doctor could have perpetrated and concealed the crimes, and I learned from Upper that he was previously acquainted with young Blattner. Doubtless the latter at some time or another had made a will or had insured his life in favor of the doctor. The latter saw his chance of acquiring wealth. It was easy for him to inoculate Mr. Blattner with the deadly germs. Then the nephew, overcome with despair at the dread news his friend had conveyed to him, shot himself. Mr. Blattner, whatever his intentions, had made no will. His fortune would pass to his nephew and from him to the doctor."
"And Mr. Schneider?"
"Well, we cannot be sure.
He knew young Bladner too, remember, and may have suspected something, or, again, the doctor may have thought that a further death, motiveless and purposeless, would strengthen the coils of superstition. Furthermore, I would tell you an interesting psychological fact, Hastings. A murderer has always a strong desire to repeat his successful crime. The performance of it grows upon him. Hence my fears for young Willard. The figure of Anubis you saw tonight was Hassan dressed up by my orders. I wanted to see if I could frighten the doctor. But it would take more than the supernatural to frighten him. I could see that he was not entirely taken in by my pretenses of belief in the occult. The little comedy I played for him did not deceive him. I suspected that he would endeavor to make me the next victim. Ah, but in spite of la mer maudite, the heat abominable, and the annoyances of the sand, their little grey cells still functioned.
Well, Poirot proved to be perfectly right in his premises. Young Bleibner, some years ago, in a fit of drunken merriment, had made a jocular will, leaving my cigarette case you admire so much and everything else of which I die possessed, which will be principally debts to my good friend Robert Ames, who once saved my life from drowning. The case was hushed up as far as possible, and to this day people talk of the remarkable series of deaths in connection with the tomb of Menhera as a triumphal proof of the vengeance of a bygone king upon the desecrators of his tomb. A belief which, as Poirot pointed out to me, is contrary to all Egyptian belief and thought. The Jewel Robbery at the Grand Metropolitan. "Poirot," I said, "a change of air would do you good."
"Oh, you think so, mon ami?"
"I am sure of it."
"Eh? Eh?" said my friend, smiling. "It is all arranged, then?"
"Will you come?"
"Where do you propose to take me?"
"Brighton. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine in the city put me onto a very good thing, and, well, I have money to burn, as the saying goes. Now, I think a weekend at the Grand Metropolitan would do us all the good in the world."
"Well, thank you. I accept most gratefully. You have the good heart to think of an old man, and the good heart, it is, in the end, worth all the little grey cells." "Yes, yes, I who speak to you am in danger of forgetting that sometimes."
I did not relish the implication. I fancy that Poirot is sometimes a little inclined to underestimate my mental capacities, but his pleasure was so evident that I put my slight annoyance aside. "Then that's all right," I said hastily. Saturday evening saw us dining at the Grand Metropolitan in the midst of a jolly throng. All the world and his wife seemed to be at Brighton. The dresses were marvellous, and the jewels, worn sometimes with more love of display than good taste, were something magnificent.
"Ah, it is a good sight, this," murmured Poirot. "This is the home of the profiteer, is it not so, Hastings?"
"No, well, supposed to be," I replied. "But we'll hope they aren't all tarred with the profiteering brush." Poirot gazed around him placidly.
"You know, the sight of so many jewels makes me wish I had turned my brains to crime instead of to its detection. What a magnificent opportunity for some thief of distinction, eh? Regard, Hastings, that stout woman by the pillar. She is, as you would say, plastered with gems."
I followed his eyes.
"Why," I exclaimed, "it's Mrs. Oppleson."
"You know her?"
Slightly.
Her husband is a rich stockbroker who made a fortune in the recent oil boom. After dinner, we ran across the Oppleson's in the lounge, and I introduced Poirot to them. We chatted for a few minutes and ended by having our coffee together. Poirot said a few words in praise of some of the costlier gems displayed on the lady's ample bosom, and she brightened up at once.
"Oh, it's a perfect hobby of mine, Monsieur Poirot. I just love jewellery. Ed knows my weakness, and every time things go well, he brings me something new. You are interested in precious stones?"
"Well, I have had a good deal to do with them one time and another, madame. My profession has brought me into contact with some of the most famous jewels in the world."
He went on to narrate, with discreet pseudonyms, the story of the historic jewels of a reigning house, and Mrs. Upperson listened with bated breath.
"Oh, there now," she exclaimed, as he ended, "if it isn't just like a play. You know, I've got some pearls of my own that have a history attached to them. I believe it's supposed to be one of the finest necklaces in the world. The pearls are so beautifully matched and so perfect in colour. I declare I really must run up and get it."
"Oh, madame," protested Poirot, "you are too aimable. Pray do not derange yourself."
"Oh, but I'd like to show it to you."
The buxom dame waddled across to the lift briskly enough. Her husband, who had been talking to me, looked at Poirot inquiringly.
"Madame, your wife is so amiable as to insist on showing me her pearl necklace," explained the latter.
"Oh, the pearls."
Upperson smiled in a satisfied fashion.
"Well, they are worth seeing. Cost a pretty penny, too. Still, the money's there, all right. I could get what I paid for them any day. Well, perhaps more. Well, may have to, too, if things go on as they are now. Money's confoundedly tight in the city. All this infernal EPD, he rambled on, launching into technicalities where I could not follow him.
He was interrupted by a small page boy who approached and murmured something in his ear.
"Eh? What? What? Oh, well, yes, I'll come at once. Not taken ill, is she? Excuse me, gentlemen."
He left us abruptly. Poirot leaned back and lit one of his tiny Russian cigarettes. Then, carefully and meticulously, he arranged the empty coffee cups in a neat row and beamed happily on the result. The minutes passed. The Opplesons did not return.
"Curious," I remarked at length.
"I wonder when they will come back."
Poirot watched the ascending spirals of smoke and then said thoughtfully,
"They will not come back."
"Oh, why?"
"Because, my friend, something has happened."
"Well, what sort of thing? How do you know?" I asked curiously.
Poirot smiled.
"A few minutes ago, the manager came hurriedly out of his office and ran upstairs. Now, he was much agitated. The lift boy is deep in talk with one of the pages. The lift bell has rung 3 times, but he heeds it not. Thirdly, even the waiters are distrait. And to make a waiter distrait..."
Poirot shook his head with an air of finality.
"The affair must indeed be of the first magnitude." "Ah, it is as I thought. Here come the police."
2 men had just entered the hotel, one in uniform, the other in plain clothes. They spoke to a page and were immediately ushered upstairs. A few minutes later, the same boy descended and came up to where we were sitting. "Mr. Upperson's compliments, and would you step upstairs?" Poirot sprang nimbly to his feet. One would have said that he awaited the summons. I followed with no less alacrity. The Upperson's apartments were situated on the first floor. After knocking on the door, the page boy retired, and we answered the summons.
"Come in."
A strange scene met our eyes. The room was Mrs. Opplesen's bedroom, and in the centre of it, lying back in an armchair, was the lady herself, weeping violently. She presented an extraordinary spectacle, with the tears making great furrows in the powder with which her complexion was liberally coated. Mr. Opplesen was striding up and down angrily. The 2 police officials stood in the middle of the room, one with a notebook in hand. A hotel chambermaid, looking frightened to death, stood by the fireplace, and on the other side of the room, a Frenchwoman, obviously Mrs. Upperson's maid, was weeping and wringing her hands with an intensity of grief that rivaled that of her mistress. Into this pandemonium stepped Poirot, neat and smiling. Immediately, with an energy surprising in one of her bulk, Mrs. Upplesen sprang from her chair towards him.
"There now. Ed may say what he likes, but I believe in luck, I do. It was fated I should meet you the way I did this evening, and I've a feeling that if you can't get my pearls back for me, nobody can."
"Now calm yourself, I pray of you, madame."
Poirot patted her hand soothingly.
"Reassure yourself. All will be well. Hercule Poirot will aid you."
Mr. Upplesen turned to the police inspector.
There'll be no objection to my calling in this gentleman, I suppose?
None at all, sir, replied the man civilly, but with complete indifference.
Perhaps now your lady's feeling better, she'll just let us have the facts.
Mrs. Oppleson looked helplessly at Poirot. He led her back to her chair.
Now sit yourself, madame, and recount to us the whole history without agitating yourself.
Thus abjured, Mrs. Oppleson dried her eyes gingerly and began.
I came upstairs after dinner to fetch my pearls for Mr. Poirot here to see. The chambermaid and Celestine were both in the room as usual.
Excuse me, madame, but what do you mean by as usual?
Mr. Oppleson explained.
Well, I make it a rule that no one is to come into this room unless Celestine, the maid, is there also. The chambermaid does the room in the morning while Celestine is present and comes in after dinner to turn down the beds under the same conditions. Otherwise, she never enters the room.
Well, as I was saying, continued Mrs. Oppleson, I came up, I went to the drawer here,
she indicated the bottom right-hand drawer of the knee-hole dressing table,
took out my jewel case and unlocked it. It seemed quite as usual, but the pearls were not there.
The inspector had been busy with his notebook.
When had you last seen them? He asked.
Well, they were there when I went down to dinner.
You're sure?
Oh, quite sure. I was uncertain whether to wear them or not, but in the end I decided on the emeralds and put the pearls back in the jewel case.
And who locked up the jewel case?
I did. I wear the key on a chain round my neck.
She held it up as she spoke. The inspector examined it and shrugged his shoulders.
Well, the thief must have had a duplicate key.
It was no difficult matter. The lock is quite a simple one. And now, what did you do after you'd locked the jewel case?
I put it back in the bottom drawer where I always keep it.
You didn't lock the drawer?
No, I never do. My maid remains in the room till I come up, so there's no need.
The inspector's face grew greyer. So am I to understand that the jewels were there when you went down to dinner, and that since then the maid has not left the room? Suddenly, as though the horror of her own situation for the first time burst upon her, Celestine uttered a piercing shriek, and flinging herself upon Poirot, poured out a torrent of incoherent French. Oh, the suggestion was infamous, that she should be suspected of robbing Madame. The police were well known to be of a stupidity incredible, but Monsieur, who was a Frenchman...
A Belgian, interjected Poirot.
But Celestine paid no attention to the correction.
Oh, Monsieur would not stand by and see her falsely accused, while that infamous chambermaid was allowed to go scot-free. No, she had never liked her. A bold, red-faced thing, a born thief. She had said from the first that she was not honest, and had kept a sharp watch over her, too, when she was doing Madame's room. Let those idiots of policemen search her, and if they did not find Madame's pearls on her, it would be very surprising.
Although this harangue was uttered in rapid and virulent French, Celestine had interlarded it with a wealth of gesture, and the chambermaid realized at least a part of her meaning. She reddened angrily.
Well, if that foreign woman's saying I took the pearls, it's a lie,
she declared heatedly.
I never so much as saw them.
Search her, screamed the other. You will find it as I say.
Well, you're a liar, do you hear?
Said the chambermaid, advancing upon her.
Stole them yourself, and want to put it on me. Why, I was only in the room about 3 minutes before the lady came up, and then you were sitting here the whole time, as you always do, like a cat watching a mouse.
The inspector looked across inquiringly at Celestine.
Is that true? Didn't you leave the room at all?
Well, I did not actually leave her alone,
admitted Celestine reluctantly.
But I went into my own room through the door here twice. Once to fetch a reel of cotton and once for my scissors. She must have done it then. But you wasn't gone a minute,
retorted the chambermaid angrily.
Just popped out and in again. I'd be glad if the police would search me. I've got nothing to be afraid of.
At this moment, there was a tap at the door. The inspector went to it. His face brightened when he saw who it was.
Ah,
he said. Oh, that was rather fortunate. I sent for one of our female searchers, and she's just arrived. Perhaps if you wouldn't mind going into the room next door? He looked at the chambermaid, who stepped across the threshold with a toss of her head. the searcher following her closely. The French girl had sunk sobbing into a chair. Poirot was looking around the room.
"Where does that door lead?"
he inquired, nodding his head toward the one by the window.
"Into the next apartment, I believe," said the inspector. "It's bolted anyway on this side."
Poirot walked across to it, tried it, then drew back the bolt and tried it again.
"And on the other side as well?"
he remarked. "Well, that seems to rule out that."
He walked over to the windows, examining each of them in turn.
"Ah, and again, nothing, not even a balcony outside."
"Well, even if there were," said the inspector impatiently, "I don't see how that would help us, if the maid never left the room."
"Oh, évidemment," said Poirot, not disconcerted. "As mademoiselle is positive she did not leave the room..."
He was interrupted by the reappearance of the chambermaid and the police searcher.
"Nothing,"
said the latter, laconically.
"Well, I should hope not indeed," said the chambermaid virtuously. "And that French hussy ought to be ashamed of herself taking away an honest girl's character."
"Now there, there, my girl, that's all right," said the inspector, opening the door. "Nobody suspects you. You go along and get on with your work."
The chambermaid went unwillingly.
"You're going to search her?"
she demanded, pointing at Célestine.
"Yes, yes."
He shut the door on her and turned the key. Célestine accompanied the searcher into the small room in her turn. A few minutes later, she also returned. Nothing had been found on her. The inspector's face grew graver.
I'm afraid I'll have to ask you to come along with me all the same, miss."
He turned to Mrs. Oppleson. "I'm sorry, madam, but all the evidence points that way. If she's not got them on her, they are hidden somewhere about the room." Célestine uttered a piercing shriek and clung to Poirot's arm. The latter bent and whispered something in the girl's ear. She looked up at him doubtfully.
"Si, si, mon enfant. I assure you, it is better not to resist."
Then he turned to the inspector.
"You permit, monsieur? A little experiment, purely for my own satisfaction."
"Depends on what it is," replied the police officer non-committedly. Poirot addressed Célestine once more.
"You have told us that you went into your room to fetch a reel of cotton. Now, whereabouts was it?"
"On top of the chest of drawers, monsieur."
"And the scissors?"
"Oh, they also."
"Now, would it be troubling you too much, mademoiselle, to ask you to repeat those two actions? You are sitting here with your work, you say?"
Célestine sat down, and then, at a sign from Poirot, rose, passed into the adjoining room, took up an object from the chest of drawers, and returned. Poirot divided his attention between her movements and a large turnip of a watch, which he held in the palm of his hand.
"Again, if you please, mademoiselle."
At the conclusion of the second performance, he made a note in his pocketbook and returned the watch to his pocket.
"Thank you, mademoiselle. And you, monsieur,"
he bowed to the inspector,
"for your courtesy."
The inspector seemed somewhat entertained by this excessive politeness. Célestine departed in a flood of tears, accompanied by the woman and the plain-clothes official. Then, with a brief apology to Mrs. Oppleson, the inspector set to work to ransack the room. He pulled out drawers, opened cupboards, completely unmade the bed, and tapped the floor. Mr. Oppleson looked on sceptically.
"You really think you'll find them?"
"Yes, sir. It stands to reason. She hadn't time to take them out of the room. The lady's discovering the robbery so soon upset her plans."
"No, they're here right enough."
"One of the two must have hidden them, and it's very unlikely for the chambermaid to have done so."
"More than unlikely. Impossible," said Poirot quietly.
"Eh?" The inspector stared. Poirot smiled modestly.
"I will demonstrate. Hastings, my good friend, take my watch in your hand."
"With care. It is a family heirloom."
"No, just now I timed mademoiselle's movements. Her first absence from the room was of 12 seconds. Her second, of 15. Now, observe my actions. Madame will have the kindness to give me the key of the jewel case. I thank you. My friend Hastings will have the kindness to say go.
Go, I said. With almost incredible swiftness, Poirot wrenched open the drawer of the dressing table, extracted the jewel case, fitted the key in the lock, opened the case, selected a piece of jewelry, shut and locked the case, and returned it to the drawer, which he pushed to again. His movements were like lightning.
Well, mon ami,
he demanded of me breathlessly. 46 seconds, I replied.
Ah, you see,
he looked around.
There would have not been time for the chambermaid even to take the necklace out, far less hide it.
Well, that settles it on the maid, said the inspector with satisfaction, and returned to his search. He passed into the maid's bedroom next door. Poirot was frowning thoughtfully. Suddenly he shot a question at Mr. Oppleson.
This necklace, it was without doubt insured?
Mr. Oppleson looked a trifle surprised at the question.
Yes, he said hesitatingly. That is so.
Oh, but what does that matter? Broke in Mrs. Oppleson tearfully. It's my necklace I want. It was unique. No money could be the same.
Oh, I comprehend, madame, said Poirot soothingly. I comprehend perfectly. To la femme, sentiment is everything. Is it not so? But, monsieur, who has not the so fine susceptibility will doubtless find some slight consolation in the fact.
Well, of course, said Mr. Oppleson rather uncertainly. Still,
He was interrupted by a shout of triumph from the inspector. He came in dangling something from his fingers. With a cry, Mrs. Oppleson heaved herself up from her chair. She was a changed woman.
Oh, my necklace!
She clasped it to her breast with both hands. We crowded round.
Well, where was it? Demanded Oppleson.
Maid's bed, in among the springs of the wire mattress. Oh, she must have stolen it and hidden it there before the chambermaid arrived on the scene.
You permit, madame?
Said Poirot gently. He took the necklace from her and examined it closely, then handed it back with a bow. I'm afraid, madame, you'll have to hand it over to us for the time being, said the inspector. We shall want it for the charge, but it shall be returned to you as soon as possible. Mr. Oppleson frowned.
Is that necessary?
I'm afraid so, sir. Just a formality.
Oh, let him take it, Ed, cried his wife. I'd feel safer if he did. I shouldn't sleep a wink thinking someone else might try to get hold of it. Oh, that wretched girl! And I would never have believed it of her.
Ah, there, there, my dear. Don't take on so.
I felt a gentle pressure on my arm. It was Poirot.
Shall we slip away, my friend? I think our services are no longer needed.
Once outside, however, he hesitated, and then, much to my surprise, he remarked,
I should rather like to see the room next door.
The door from the corridor was not locked, and we entered. The room, which was a large double one, was unoccupied. Dust lay about rather noticeably, and my sensitive friend gave a characteristic grimace as he ran his finger round a rectangular mark on a table near the window.
The service leaves to be desired, he observed dryly.
He was staring thoughtfully out of the window and seemed to have fallen into a brown study.
Well,
I demanded impatiently,
what did we come in here for?
He started.
Ah, je vous demande pardon, mon ami. I wish to see if the door was really bolted on this side also.
Well, I said, glancing at the door which communicated with the room we had just left, it is bolted. Poirot nodded. He still seemed to be thinking. And anyway, I continued, what does it matter? The case is over. I wish you'd had more chance of distinguishing yourself. But it was the kind of case that even a stiff-backed idiot like that inspector couldn't go wrong over. Poirot shook his head.
The case is not over, my friend. It will not be over until we find out
who stole the pearls.
But the maid did.
Why do you say that?
Why? I stammered. Well, they were found, actually, in her mattress.
Ah, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, said Poirot impatiently. Those were not the pearls.
What?
Imitation, mon ami.
The statement took my breath away. Poirot was smiling placidly.
The good inspector obviously knows nothing of jewels, but presently there will be a fine hullabaloo.
Come, I cried, dragging at his arm.
Where?
Well, we must tell the Opplesons at once.
Oh, I think not.
But that poor woman...
Eh bien, that poor woman, as you call her, will have a much better night believing the jewels to be safe.
Yeah, but the thief may escape with them.
As usual, my friend, you speak without reflection. How do you know that the pearls Mrs. Opplesons locked up so carefully tonight were not the false ones, eh? And that the real robbery did not take place at a much earlier date?
Oh, I said, bewildered.
Exactly, said Poirot, beaming. We start again.
He led the way out of the room, paused a moment as though considering, and then walked down to the end of the corridor, stopping outside the small den where the chambermaids and valets of the respective floors congregated. Our particular chambermaid appeared to be holding a small court there, and to be retailing her late experiences to an appreciative audience. She stopped in the middle of a sentence. Poirot bowed with his usual politeness.
Excuse that I derange you, huh? But I shall be obliged if you will unlock for me the door of Mr. Opplesons' room.
The woman rose willingly, and we accompanied her down the passage again. Mr. Opplesons' room was on the other side of the corridor, its door facing that of his wife's room. The chambermaid unlocked it with her passkey, and we entered. As she was about to depart, Poirot detained her.
One moment. Have you ever seen among the effects of Mr. Opplesons a card like this?
He held out a plain white card, rather highly glazed and uncommon in appearance. The maid took it and scrutinized it carefully.
No, oh, no, sir, I can't say I have. But anyway, the valet has most to do with the gentleman's rooms.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
Poirot took back the card. The woman departed. Poirot appeared to reflect a little. Then he gave a short, sharp nod of the head.
Ring the bell, I pray of you, Hastings, 3 times for the valet.
I obeyed, devoured with curiosity. Meanwhile, Poirot had emptied the waste paper basket on the floor and was swiftly going through its contents. In a few moments, the valet answered the bell. To him, Poirot put the same question and handed him the card to examine. But the response was the same. The valet had never seen a card of that particular quality among Mr. Opplesons' belongings. Poirot thanked him, and he withdrew, somewhat unwillingly, with an inquisitive glance at the overturned waste paper basket and the litter on the floor. He could hardly have helped overhearing Poirot's thoughtful remark as he bundled the torn papers back again.
And the necklace was heavily insured, eh?
"Poirot!" I cried. "I see."
"Ah, you see nothing, my friend," he replied quickly. "As usual, nothing at all. It is incredible, but there it is. Let us return to our own apartments."
We did so in silence. Once there, to my intense surprise, Poirot effected a rapid change of clothing.
"I go to London tonight," he explained. "It is imperative."
"What?"
"No, absolutely. The real work, that of the brain. Ah, those brave little grey cells. It is done. I go to seek the confirmation. I shall find it. Impossible to deceive Hercule Poirot."
"You'll come a cropper one of these days," I observed, rather disgusted by his vanity.
"Oh, do not be enraged, I beg of you, mon ami. I count on you to do me a service of your friendship."
"Oh, of course," I said eagerly, rather ashamed of my moroseness. "What is it?"
"The sleeve of my coat that I have taken off. Will you brush it? You see, you, a little white powder has clung to it. You, without doubt, observed me run my finger around the drawer of the dressing table?"
No, I didn't.
Ah, you should observe my actions, my friend. Thus, I obtained the powder on my finger, and being a little overexcited, I rubbed it on my sleeve. An action without method, which I deplore, false to all my principles.
But what was the powder? I asked, not particularly interested in Poirot's principles.
Well, not the poison of the Bourget,
replied Poirot with a twinkle.
I see your imagination mounting. I should say it was French chalk.
Well, French chalk?
Yes. Cabinet makers use it to make drawers run smoothly.
I laughed. You old sinner! I thought you were working up to something exciting.
Au revoir, my friend. I save myself. I fly.
The door shut behind him. With a smile, half of derision, half of affection, I picked up the coat and stretched out my hand for the clothes brush. The next morning, hearing nothing from Poirot, I went out for a stroll, met some old friends, and lunched with them at their hotel. In the afternoon, we went for a spin. A punctured tire delayed us, and it was past 8 when I got back to the Grand Metropolitan. The first sight that met my eyes was Poirot, looking even more diminutive than usual, sandwiched between the Opplesons, beaming in a state of placid satisfaction.
"Ah, mon ami Hastings!" he cried, and sprang to meet me. "Embrace me, my friend. All has marched to a marvel."
Luckily, the embrace was merely figurative. Not a thing one is always sure of with Poirot. "Do you mean..." I began.
"Oh, just wonderful, I call it,"
said Mrs. Opplesen, smiling all over her fat face. "Didn't I tell you, Ed, that if he couldn't get back my pearls, nobody would?"
You did, my dear, you did, and you were right.
I looked helplessly at Poirot, and he answered the glance.
"My friend Hastings is, as you say in England, all at the seaside. Seat yourself, and I will recount to you all the affair that has so happily ended."
"Ended?
Oh, but yes. They are arrested?"
"Well, who are arrested?"
"The chambermaid and the valet, parbleu. You did not suspect, eh? Not with my parting hint about the French chalk?"
"Well, you said cabinet makers used it."
"But certainly they do, to make drawers slide easily. Somebody wanted a drawer to slide in and out without any noise. Who could that be, Obviously, only the chambermaid. The plan was so ingenious that it did not at once leap to the eye, not even to the eye of Hercule Poirot. Now listen, this was how it was done. The valet was in the empty room next door, waiting. The French maid leaves the room. Quick as a flash, the chambermaid whips open the drawer, takes out the jewel case, and, slipping back the bolt, passes it through the door. The valet opens it at his leisure with the duplicate key with which he has provided himself, extracts the necklace, and waits his time. Celestine leaves the room again, and, pssst, in a flash, the case is passed back again and replaced in the drawer. Madame arrives. The theft is discovered. The chambermaid demands to be searched with a good deal of righteous indignation, and leaves the room without a stain on her character. The imitation necklace with which they have provided themselves has been concealed in the French girl's bed that morning by the chambermaid. A masterstroke, sir.
But what did you go to London for?
You remember the card?
Certainly. It puzzled me. Well, it puzzles me still. I thought... Well, I hesitated delicately, glancing at Mr. Opplesen. Poirot laughed heartily.
Une blague for the benefit of the valet. The card was one with a specially prepared surface for fingerprints. I went straight to Scotland Yard, asked for our old friend Inspector Japp, and laid the facts before him. As I had suspected, the fingerprints proved to be those of two well-known jewel thieves who had been wanted for some time. Japp came down with me. The thieves were arrested, and the necklace was discovered in the valet's possession. A clever pair, but they failed in method.
Have I not told you, Hastings, at least 36 times that without method...
At least 36,000 times, I interrupted. But where did their method break down?
Mon ami, it is a good plan to take a place as chambermaid or valet. But you must not shirk your work. They left an empty room undusted, and therefore, when the man put down the jewel case on the little table near the communicating door, it left a square mark.
But I remember, I cried.
Before, I was undecided. Then, I knew.
There was a moment's silence.
And I've got my pearls, said Mrs. Oppleson as a sort of Greek chorus.
Well, I said, I had better have some dinner. Poirot accompanied me. Well, this ought to mean kudos for you, I observed.
Oh, pas de tout, replied Poirot tranquilly. Jappe and the local inspector will divide the credit between them, but,
he tapped his pocket,
I have a check here from Mr. Upperson and, how you say, my friend. This weekend has not gone according to plan. Shall we return here next weekend at my expense this time?
The Kidnapped Prime Minister. Now that war and the problems of war are things of the past, I think I may safely venture to reveal to the world the part which my friend Poirot played in a moment of national crisis. The secret has been well guarded. Not a whisper of it reached the press. But now that the need for secrecy has gone by, I feel it is only just that England should know the debt it owes to my quaint little friend, whose marvellous brain so ably averted a great catastrophe. One evening, after dinner, I will not particularise the date. It suffices to say that it was at the time when peace by negotiation was the parrot cry of England's enemies. My friend and I were sitting in his rooms. After being invalided out of the army, I had been given a recruiting job, and it had become my custom to drop in on Poirot in the evenings after dinner and talk with him of any cases of interest that he might have had on hand. I was attempting to discuss with him the sensational news of the day, no less than the attempted assassination of Mr. David McAdam, England's Prime Minister. The account in the newspapers had evidently been carefully censored. No details were given, save that the Prime Minister had had a marvellous escape, the bullet just grazing his cheek. I considered that our police must have been shamefully careless for such an outrage to be possible. I could well understand that the German agents in England would be willing to risk much for such an achievement. Fighting Mac, as his own party had nicknamed him, had strenuously and unequivocally combated the pacifist influence which was becoming so prevalent. He was more than England's Prime Minister. He was England. And to have removed him from his sphere of influence would have been a crushing and paralysing blow to Britain. Poirot was busy mopping a grey suit with a minute sponge. Never was there a dandy such as Hercule Poirot. Neatness and order were his passion. Now, with the odour of benzene filling the air, he was quite unable to give me his full attention.
In a little minute I am with you, my friend. I have all but finished. The spot of grease, he is not good, huh? I remove him, so.
He waved his sponge. I smiled as I lit another cigarette. Anything interesting on? I inquired after a minute or two.
I assist a charlady to find her husband. A difficult affair, needing the tact. For I have a little idea that when he is found, he will not be pleased. What would you? For my part, I sympathize with him. He was a man of discrimination to lose himself.
I laughed.
Ah, at last, the spot of grease. He is gone. I am at your disposal.
Well, I was asking you what you thought of this attempt to assassinate McAdam.
Enfantillage, replied Poirot promptly. One can hardly take it seriously. To fire with the rifle never does it succeed. It is a device from the past.
Well, it was very near succeeding this time, I reminded him. Poirot shook his head impatiently. He was about to reply when the landlady thrust her head round the door and informed him that there were two gentlemen below who wanted to see him.
They won't give their names, sir, but they says as it's very important.
Let them mount, said Poirot, carefully folding his grey trousers. In a few minutes, the two visitors were ushered in, and my heart gave a leap as in the foremost I recognised no less a personage than Lord Astaire, leader of the House of Commons, whilst his companion, Mr. Bernard Dodge, was also a member of the War Cabinet and, as I knew, a close personal friend of the Prime Minister.
Monsieur Poirot, said Lord Astaire interrogatively.
My friend bowed. The great man looked at me and hesitated.
My business is private.
Oh, you may speak freely before Captain Hastings, said my friend, nodding to me to remain. He has not all the gifts, no, but I answer for his discretion.
Lord Astaire still hesitated, but Mr. Dodge broke in abruptly.
Oh, come on! Don't let's beat about the bush. As far as I can see, the whole of England will know the hole we're in soon enough. Time's everything.
Pray be seated, monsieur, said Poirot politely. Will you take the big chair, my lord?
Lord Astaire started slightly.
You know me?
Poirot smiled.
Certainly. I read the little papers with the pictures. How should I not know you?
Well, Monsieur Poirot, I've come to consult you upon a matter of the most vital urgency. I must ask for absolute secrecy.
You have the word of Hercule Poirot. I can say no more, said my friend grandiloquently.
Well, it concerns the Prime Minister. We are in grave trouble.
Ha! We're up a tree, interposed Mr. Dodge.
But the injury is serious, then, I asked.
What injury?
Well, the bullet wound.
Oh, that,
cried Mr. Dodge contemptuously.
That's old history.
Well, as my colleague says, continued Lord Astaire, that affair is over and done with. Luckily, it failed. I wish I could say as much for the second attempt.
Ah, there has been a second attempt, then?
Yes, though not of the same nature. Monsieur Poirot, the Prime Minister, has disappeared.
What?
He has been kidnapped.
Impossible!
I cried, stupefied. Poirot threw a withering glance at me, which I knew enjoined me to keep my mouth shut.
Now, unfortunately, impossible as it seems, it is only too true, continued his lordship.
Poirot looked at Mr. Dodge.
You said just now, monsieur, that time was everything. What did you mean by that?
The two men exchanged glances, and then Lord Astaire said,
You have heard, Monsieur Poirot, of the approaching Allied conference.
My friend nodded.
Well, for obvious reasons, no details have been given of when and where it is to take place. But, although it has been kept out of the newspapers, the date is, of course, widely known in diplomatic circles. The conference is to be held tomorrow, Thursday evening, at Versailles. Now, you perceive the terrible gravity of the situation. I will not conceal from you that the Prime Minister's presence at the conference is a vital necessity. The pacifist propaganda, started and maintained by the German agents in our midst, has been very active. It is the universal opinion that the turning point of the conference will be the strong personality of the Prime Minister. His absence may have the most serious results, possibly a premature and disastrous peace. And we have no one who can be sent in his place. He alone can represent England.
Poirot's face had grown very grave.
Then you regard the kidnapping of the Prime Minister as a direct attempt to prevent his being present at the conference?
Oh, most certainly I do. He was actually on his way to France at the time.
And the conference is to be held?
At 9 o'clock tomorrow night.
Poirot drew an enormous watch from his pocket.
It is now 9:15.
Yes, 24 hours, said Mr. Dodge thoughtfully.
And 1/4, amended Poirot. Do not forget 1/4, monsieur. It may come in useful. Now, for the details. The abduction, did it take place in England or in France?
In France. Mr. McAdam crossed to France this morning. He was to stay tonight as the guest of the Commander-in-Chief, proceeding tomorrow to Paris. He was conveyed across the channel by destroyer. At Boulogne, he was met by a car from General Headquarters and one of the Commander-in-Chief's ADCs.
Eh bien?
Well, they started from Boulogne, but they never arrived.
What?
Monsieur Poirot, it was a bogus car and a bogus ADC. The real car was found in a side road, with the chauffeur and the ADC neatly gagged and bound.
And the bogus car?
Is still at large. Poirot made a gesture of impatience.
Incredible! Surely it cannot escape attention for long.
Well, so we thought. It seemed merely a question of searching thoroughly. That part of France is under military law. We were convinced that the car could not go long unnoticed. The French police and our own Scotland Yard men and the military are straining every nerve. It is, as you say, incredible. But nothing has been discovered. At that moment, a tap came at the door, and a young officer entered with a heavily sealed envelope, which he handed to Lord Astaire.
Just through from France, sir. I brought it on here, as you directed.
The minister tore it open eagerly and uttered an exclamation. The officer withdrew.
Ah, here is news at last. This telegram has just been decoded. They have found the second car. Also, the secretary, Daniels, chloroformed, gagged, and bound in an abandoned farm near... We can't mention the name here. Now, he remembers nothing except something being pressed against his mouth and nose from behind and struggling to free himself. The police are satisfied as to the genuineness of his statement.
And they have found nothing else?
No.
Not the Prime Minister's dead body? Then there is hope. But it is strange. Why, after trying to shoot him this morning, are they now taking so much trouble to keep him alive?
Dodge shook his head.
Well, one thing's quite certain. They're determined at all costs to prevent his attending the conference.
If it is humanly possible, the Prime Minister shall be there. God grant it is not too late. Now, monsieur, recount to me everything from the beginning. I must know about the shooting affair as well.
Last night, the Prime Minister, accompanied by one of his secretaries, Captain Daniels...
The same who accompanied him to France?
Yes. Well, as I was saying, they motored down to Windsor, where the Prime Minister was granted an audience. Early this morning he returned to town, and it was on the way that the attempted assassination took place.
One moment, if you please. Who is this Captain Daniels? You have his dossier?
Lord Astaire smiled. I thought you would ask me that. We do not know very much about him. He is of no particular family. He has served in the English army and is an extremely able secretary, being an exceptionally fine linguist. I believe he speaks 7 languages. It is for that reason that the Prime Minister chose him to accompany him to France.
Has he any relatives in England?
2 aunts, a Mrs. Everard, who lives at Hampstead, and a Miss Daniels, who lives near Ascot.
Ascot? That is near to Windsor, is it not?
Yes, well, the point has not been overlooked, but it has led to nothing.
You regard the Captain Daniels, then, as above suspicion?
A shade of bitterness crept into Lord Astaire's voice as he replied,
No, Monsieur Poirot, in these days I should hesitate before I pronounced anyone above suspicion.
Très bien. Now I understand, my lord, that the Prime Minister would, as a matter of course, be under vigilant police protection, which ought to render any assault upon him an impossibility.
Lord Astaire bowed his head.
That is so. The Prime Minister's car was closely followed by another car containing detectives in plain clothes. Mr. McAdam knew nothing of these precautions. He is personally a most fearless man and would be inclined to sweep them away arbitrarily. But, naturally, the police make their own arrangements. In fact, the Premier's chauffeur, O'Murphy, is a CID man.
O'Murphy? Oh, that is a name of Ireland, is it not so?
Yes, he's an Irishman.
From what part of Ireland?